You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
During the 4 years before the first free elections in post-apartheid South Africa, the pictures taken by a group of young photojournalists attracted global attention for how they captured the brutal violence that engulfed the region in the early 90s. The four photographers became known as the Bang Bang Club, and two of them would go on to win Pulitzer Prizes. This Friday, a feature film, that's tomorrow actually, a feature film called The Bang Bang Club, based on a book of the same name, opens at the Village East Cinema as part of the Tribeca Film Festival, and it stars Ryan Philippe as one of the members of the group, Greg Marinovich. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show, along with the real Greg Marinovich. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
Greg, just yesterday we learned of the tragic deaths of two longtime combat photojournalists who actually appeared on the show earlier, Tim Hetherington and Chris Hondros in Misrata, Libya, reportedly by a rocket-propelled grenade. Two other photographers working alongside them were also injured in the attack. Did you know any of them?
I knew Chris by email, and that was it. You know, I've stopped covering wars a while ago, so I kind of lost touch with that.
Well, when I look at this kind of story, I wonder what precautions photojournalists can even take in frontline combat situations.
It all depends on the conflict. I mean, in this case, it's a real army against a ragtag bunch of people who want to liberate themselves. And it makes a very fluid, very dangerous, unpredictable situations. And even people with a lot of experience, which those two had, you can't really prepare yourself. And what you've got to decide is, am I going to do it or am I not going to do it?
What's the dominant feeling when you're in a dangerous situation? The adrenaline rush or tremendous fear? Are you even aware of fear when you have a camera, when you're clicking away with a camera?
Speaking for myself, it's fear. it differs. And really, it from moment to moment, it changes. You know, one moment you're having a great time and eating shish kebab in some exotic place for like 50 cents, a great meal. And then the next moment you're terrified and wishing you hadn't actually eaten that meal.
Because it's upsetting your stomach.
Well, no, because you're worried it's going to come out.
Ryan, I've heard that you almost didn't come on board with this project because of your own experience with photographers. Are you talking about paparazzi?
Yeah, I think initially there was something, there was a transition that needed to take place within me about there's been a development of sort of antagonistic relationship with the camera for me the last decade of my life or so.
But you've lived by the camera, at least the movie camera.
Certainly, yeah. It's just I think the invasion aspect has been something that I've struggled with, and to see a photographer as something heroic or noble was a difficulty for me initially, and was something I kind of I watched a documentary about James Noctway. The great Time magazine photographer, and there was a moment in that documentary where he's photographing a woman whose son has just been killed, and that was initially I thought it was such an intrusive position, but then I realized that without him being there, this woman's story goes, you know. It's unreported, and the loss that she's experienced is not documented, and I came to realize how important it is, and how, you know.
But it's also a complex situation, and that's a lot more fun for an actor than somebody who's just all good or all bad.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Greg, you covered a very different kind of conflict from the one in Libya in the early 90s. What was happening in South Africa immediately after Nelson Mandela's release from prison?
There were a lot of complicated things and social positions happening. The one was obviously the liberation movements had been unbanned, so political freedoms were available, and with that comes competition. And so on that side, it was the ANC against Inkatha, the Zulu-dominated movement, who were vying for supremacy.
So it looks like a black against black power struggle.
Precisely. But what you couldn't see was that under all this was the apartheid regime trying to manipulate that result to exactly show that opinion.
Now, was that something that was even apparent to somebody like you? First of all, you're coming out of the white community in South Africa, you might have seen the world a little differently if you had been black.
Absolutely. I mean, South Africa was and is a country completely dominated by race. But I was very aware of that, and, you know, I was involved in trying to show the effects of apartheid before that war started. So I was aware of these things. And very early on, it was obvious to anyone spending time there that there was this hidden force, which is called the Third Force by Nelson Mandela himself, but was dismissed by many analysts and experts.
F.W. de Klerk has been a guest on this show. I think he probably tells a very different story.
He would.
But he's very proud of the fact that he opened it up. And things did change as a result, even if you almost would assume that for a time everybody would try to hold on to as much power as possible.
You know, whatever his faults and whatever sins and ills he committed as the National Party, who were the party that codified apartheid, whatever he did, he also was the one who allowed the vast majority of our population to attain their freedoms by not making it a real civil war, by not involving the police and the army in crushing or trying to crush this popular uprising. So he absolutely did some very good things, but like all of us, he's flawed.
But on the surface, you were four white photographers documenting a black war. I'm assuming that it would have been different if you had been black photographers. Were there black photographers even covering the story?
Absolutely, and the book tells of that. I mean, the movie is an abstraction of a book, which is an abstraction in itself, obviously. So everything gets simplified and whatever.
Yeah.
But
and
obviously,
it doesn't bother you that the film takes so much artistic license at times?
Sometimes it does, but I didn't make the movie. You know, I wrote the book, and what is good is that it raises awareness of other issues, and the movie is what the movie is.
Were there women working as photographers at the time?
There were. Not in the conflict zones, but there were obviously not just photographers. There were some very courageous frontline radio journalists who were women, who we worked with, and writers. But obviously the camera being the jewelry around the neck has made it, it has become the four photographers, which it never was, really.
Right, the film was shot in South Africa, mm-hmm. wasn't it? In places often where the actual massacres had occurred. Didn't some family and friends of victims come out on the streets while you were shooting?
Absolutely. And, you know, this is something that Greg can certainly attest to. In the 15 years since these incidents took place, very little change and development has taken place in these areas. So they are essentially the same as they were when the story took place and when the events happened. Because I remember, Greg, you were saying that Tokoza looked exactly the way it did when you were there initially.
Identical.
Yeah.
And I mean, they almost...
You would have expected improvement.
Not just us. How about the people living there, the people who sacrificed their lives in their youth to fight for that freedom? It's quite sad. But what happened during the filming of the movie, because one of the scenes was shot in the actual location in mm-hmm. Tokoza, and there'd been a mix-up with the producers. They'd cleared and done the permissions, but with the wrong people. And so the actual former fighters, when they saw this reenactment of certain events and guys running around with Kalashnikovs who clearly were meant to be them, they came out and they wanted to shut down the movie. And in fact, I was told later by some of them, because I know them, they were going to open fire and shoot people. So that had to be massaged and worked out in the right way, and that was good. But I think it shows how raw these events are.
How aware were you of that, Ryan?
Relatively, I was. I mean, it wasn't something that you could hide, because it was apparent that there was some sort of militia forming, which is not typical on most film sets. But what it revealed to me was how raw and how fresh the events were still in the lives of those people. And I mean, it brought a whole level of reality to what we were doing as filmmakers, as actors, that I hadn't really experienced before.
The film is based on this book that we've been talking about that Greg wrote with Joel Silver. one of the other Bang Bang Club members. Do you do a lot of research before you take on a role like this? Did you read the book?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I read the book. I read the history of South Africa. I read Mandela's book. I did a lot of historical South African research. And also, there was an interesting thing, too. You know, these guys shot on 35 millimeter film, not digital cameras, where it's just like effortless. Almost anyone can do it. You can, you know, you have exponential amount of frames.
You have to change roles in the middle of a very exciting moment and either lose a shot or have a second camera ready.
That's it. And it's quite fun because Ryan got quite into it. And all the actors did. In fact, They all took that very seriously. So it was kind of on the job training of how to do it and this and that. It was fun.
Yeah, I mean, there's some correlation. Like, that is, you know, they are out there unprotected and without a weapon, but that is sort of their ammunition in a way. The reloading of the film, to me, there was a parallel there. And then it's just the consideration required when you have a limited amount of film and frameage to work with was interesting to me. Because, you know, now with a digital camera, you can shoot thousands of photographs. And there was something interesting about the fact that you had to consider each and every shot you took in a way.
Ryan and I think Taylor were both actually shooting film in their cameras that they were using throughout the thing.
Yeah.
Did you get any good pictures out of it?
I did, actually. Yeah, yeah.
You haven't shared them, right?
No, I haven't. I should do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So on top of everything else, this is a learning experience. You're learning how to become a better photographer.
I am, yeah. And my kids are paying the price. I bet.
How can they accuse you of being paparazzi?
Why? Because they're being forced to model for you all the time?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, Dad, stop it already. So how did you get to be called the Bang Bang Club?
There was a South African magazine, now defunct, and the editor, because our pictures were appearing and they were different from most photographers' pictures. They were really showing the violence. But he chose to focus on myself, Ken, and a guy who I won't mention my name, but is very right-wing and had actually murdered two people on the job and used to drive over in a rented Mercedes to get people to stone him so he could get pictures, blah, blah, blah.
He was a photographer who also killed people?
Charming, yeah. South African. And we're a fine nation. So,
but you're also suggesting that people take sides.
He did it for the pictures. I mean, we do take sides. Why not? Well, of course you take sides. I think objectivity is a myth, quite honestly. Honesty is what it's about. So he did this article and called us the Bang Bang Paparazzi, which you would not appreciate. And we were furious and we said, this is just wrong. I mean, this is completely wrong. And also we don't want to be associated with this person. We explained the context, which he didn't know.
And also the word paparazzi suggests something else. Which
absolutely.
Is
it's insulting.
Being a photographic vulture rather than somebody who's a photojournalist.
Absolutely. I mean, we all couldn't agree more.
I mean, there's no talent or skill or risk involved in being paparazzi.
Well, Ron Galella might disagree, but still, it's a different kind of a thing. I mean, all he has to worry about is a celebrity getting annoyed and punching him in the nose.
Right, right.
And hopefully making a lot of money from it. But anyway, so he said the only thing he can do, because the magazine was out, what's the retraction going to do? He'll do another article where he interviews myself, Joao Silva, Ken Oosterbrook, and Kevin Carter. And then he said, look, but he really likes that kind of Bang Bang title. What if he calls it the Bang Bang Club? Oh, yeah. But we kind of said, well, you know, it's kind of catchy. It's quite good. That's fine. Okay. So there never was a club, obviously. There were a lot of people out there doing this. But once it became published, the perception was there was a club. And then when Kevin committed suicide in 1994, Time magazine Scott McCloud wrote an article called The Bang Bang Club.
So you took the name yourself when you wrote
your
book?
No, we never took the name.
Oh, this was given to
by
the publisher?
Title.
Yeah.
Oh, no. We had a different title. We called it The Dead Zone. And the publisher said it's got to be The Bang Bang Club.
Well, that was also a Stephen King novel.
The Dead Zone.
Yeah.
But you are allowed to use.
Yeah. Yes, you are. Yeah, you could write a novel called War and Peace.
Right.
Yeah.
But I don't suggest you do it.
Take too long.
My guests are Greg Marinovich, who is one of the photographers who is part of the story of the Bang Bang Club, a film that opens tomorrow at the Village East Cinema as part of the Tribeca Film Festival, and Ryan Philippe, who plays Greg. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Ryan Philippe and Greg Marinovich talking about The Bang Bang Club, a film that opens tomorrow at the Village East Cinema as part of the Tribeca Film Festival. Ryan, you grew up in Delaware, didn't you? And began your acting career as a teenager on One Life to Live.
I did, yeah.
Well, all of this was happening while you were still in your teens.
Yes.
How aware were you of what was happening in other parts of the world?
You know, frightfully not as aware as I feel like I should have been. I certainly knew what apartheid was. I knew the dynamics of it, but I did not know the hidden war aspect of it that the book references. I didn't know about the government supplying one side with weapons and stoking the black-on-black violence. I had really no awareness of that whatsoever.
Had you seen any of the pictures that the Bang Bang Club took before you were cast in the film?
Well, I remember, I know that during the time of Live Aid and that sort of thing, I remember the vulture photograph that Kevin Carter took. I remember seeing that. And that was the one that I think had most presence to me.
Although, Greg, the vulture photograph was taken in Sudan, wasn't it?
It was.
Now, that's a very controversial film. It's he won the Pulitzer Prize for it, but it was of a collapsed, starving Sudanese girl and a vulture waiting patiently just feet away from her body. And many people were upset because they felt he just should have shooed the vulture away or taken the girl off to some place to get her fed.
He did shoo the vulture away, but he didn't take her to the feeding center. The feeding center was very close. If you look at that picture, and you can Google it while you're listening, you'll see in the background there's huts showing through the bush. So this was within 100 meters of the feeding center, where most probably, and speaking to aid workers who'd been in Ayod in southern Sudan at the time, the mother had left her because the food had just arrived. There was a runway there where the UN was delivering food and they'd brought food. So the mother had probably left her. And that kid was probably fine. But the problem is that when you take a picture like that, you understand the power of that picture and what it implies. And then to not actually pick up the child and take it somewhere safe or just hold it or do something, obviously that's something that one wouldn't feel comfortable with having made that decision afterwards. And that was the case with Kevin.
You spoke about it with him?
Yep, we did.
As we said earlier, he committed suicide about a year after he won the Pulitzer. Was it because of the controversy surrounding that? Or do you
Many
think that,
reasons.
Well, there's so much stress in this job. I even wonder whether some photographers suffer from PTSD.
I would think so.
They do. In fact, a good friend of mine is currently in hospital, in a European hospital, suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. And he said it was hearing about Joao's loss of his legs that just triggered, and he kind of let go of his defenses. And then he met another photographer in there who we've also met covering wars. So it's like, I think it comes to a certain time where you can't just keep doing that. It's not psychically possible. And in Kevin's case, there were other factors. You know, the stress of the morality of not of taking the picture. It was absolutely right to take the picture because that picture raised millions for aid and showed the situation. But he, a father himself, was very upset that he had failed in what he believed should have been his duty in helping or comforting that child. And then, you know, he had other problems. He had drug-related problems. He had tried suicide many years before, and I think certain personalities don't take that kind of internalized stress well.
You also won a Pulitzer for a photograph of a man being slashed with a machete while his body was burning. You couldn't have done anything to help that man.
No, I mean, I did try repeatedly during that assault. It went on for a very long time, and I engaged in quite subsequently interesting discussions with the main protagonist about why he shouldn't kill him. And I explained the situation exactly a month earlier when I'd witnessed the opposite, a man from a different political party being killed, and how he actually wasn't who the people had accused him of. Now, the reason I did that was that the month before, I'd not said a word. It was my first day of covering conflict. I'd just gone into the township and decided I had to cover this if I was going to cover the social effects of apartheid. And I stumbled into this, and I photographed it, and I was too scared, too inexperienced, and too overwhelmed to say a word, even though it was within touching distance. And I had to live with that. And I'd completely let myself down. So I know how Kevin felt.
Did winning the Pulitzer make it any easier? I understand you didn't even know what the Pulitzer was when you won it.
Ignorance is a wonderful thing. I think it made it worse. It raised the stakes of the guilt of covering this kind of photography on this kind of work where, I mean, it's one thing to make your living from covering this. It's another thing to be acclaimed and given an award. And it's very, it's mixed feelings. We're not simple.
You also sought by the police in connection here with this case. They wanted you to testify.
They did. They wanted to use it because it was ANC perpetrators against an alleged Inkatha supporter. They wanted to use it for political mileage, part of that whole strategy of theirs. So at the time, I was using a false name, my mother's maiden name and my middle name, Sebastian Balich, because I was avoiding continued military service. And in fact, my lawyer said, look, I shouldn't be saying this, but I think it's time you got a plane and left.
My guests are Greg Marinovich and Ryan Philippi. We're talking about a new film called The Bang Bang Club, which opens tomorrow at the Village East Cinema as part of the Tribeca Film Festival. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, Greg, you're the only one of the club who actually came out of it intact.
Yep.
Ken Oosterbrook was shot and killed during a battle between peacekeeping soldiers and the Inthaka Zulu faction. That was while all of this was happening. That must have had an incredible impact on all of you.
Well, that was just 10 days before the election. And, things were very hot. That was in Tacosa, the place we spoke about with the militants and the SDUs. And it was just very sad, you know, but 2 months previous that another photojournalist had been killed in a neighboring township. And these are the dangers that one has to accept.
Well, you've been shot a couple of times, including during that event.
Yeah, same occasion. I mean, I thought I was going to die then. It was a chest shot, and I wasn't. But, you know, we watch a lot of movies, and any chest shot's got to be a through and through, right?
And that you didn't quit on the spot?
Not at all. In fact, I felt there's a strange sense of relief. There's this kind of guilt about photographing people suffering. And I felt a great sense of relief, and I was quite accepting of death, which obviously didn't happen, just being a drama queen, I suppose. But and also in the context of Ken being dead next to me, it does put things in perspective.
All right. The book and the film raise many ethical and moral issues of what combat photographers grapple with. What were your initial reactions to what these men and women do for a living?
Well, there is an aspect of it that I think is adrenaline related. There was something, you know, they've been compared to fighter pilots, and, you know, there's something about going into a combat zone completely unprotected with a task that is non-military related, and that I found fascinating. I've played a soldier in the past in the film I did with Clint Eastwood and a film called Stop Loss, and there's a mentality there that I completely relate to because you're prepared, you're armed, you have an obvious directive, and in this situation, I just can't imagine willingly placing yourself within a battle zone in the manner in which, you know, combat photographers do. I think it's insane, really.
A listener in Brooklyn left this comment on our show page. I'm quoting, "As someone who was there for the elections, I would like to hear more from Greg about what the world press like myself missed in its coverage. the Joburg Star was the inspiration for much of us, but that flew into the last of the story and the triumph of the Mandela moment. Do you think that the fact that you were South African allowed you to see things that the outside press didn't see? They saw this as a triumphant period.
But it was.
Because
it was
to some degree, the United States had played a role. The people outside of South Africa played a major role with sanctions and pressure on the South African government to effect that change. And it happened.
Absolutely. And I mean, if you look at this conflict that we speak about in South Africa, it was quite contained. I mean, it had been going on for a decade in KwaZulu-Natal, and this was only in KwaZulu-Natal and along the reef, the towns in and around the Johannesburg area. So it was quite contained. And overall, 400 years of racial oppression were overturned in one election. So it was an amazing triumph. And Nelson Mandela was a fantastic president and is a great human being. So, yes, it was a triumph. That doesn't mean it's an unmitigated triumph. There's always some people who get burnt along the way. And I think the poor, as they were then and as they are now, are still suffering, whether it is under apartheid or under the normal capitalist regime of the elite and the poor. They continue to suffer.
Do you think, Ryan, as a consumer of news, that the world needs more Bang Bang Club types out there documenting things, because at a certain point, people do wind up inuring themselves to all of the bad news.
Right.
I know people who just, when the news comes on and we see somebody starving, or we see the terrible situation in Japan right now, or what's going on in Haiti, they say, I can't take this. They just walk out of the room.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is a mentality that you see quite frequently. I think, you know, especially in this, you know, the time in which the story took place is before the prominence of the internet and media being the 24-hour constantly. I think that the attention brought to the situation in South Africa through their work and the photographs, you know, it really opened up the eyes of the rest of the world. I think there was a lot of ignorance and a lot of kind of it was overlooked in a lot of ways. And I think that, I think still that there's a great significance to.
Yeah, I think, I mean, there is a kind of fatigue. There's fatigue when there's famines. There's fatigue when there's conflict. But I think what's critical, and I think many journalists and people who document these things, it's there, it's documented. It's up to you to choose to look at it or not look at it. And you can't say, but we didn't know.
But it's hard for us to keep more than one thing in our minds at any time. For example, the situation in Haiti remains terrible, and yet Haiti is forgotten because we were aware of it for the first month or two, and then along came the oil spill in the Gulf, and then the tsunami and earthquake in Japan. We've had these tornadoes in our country recently, and then Libya and the Ivory Coast. I mean, it goes on and on and on. You mentioned earlier that your co-author in the book, Joao Silva, went on to the New York Times and was severely injured last October, where he lost both legs in a mine accident in Afghanistan.
Yep.
When did you decide to quit? Was it before all of this happened?
Before. I mean, I'd been wounded on four different occasions, and on the fourth time was actually in Afghanistan in 1999, before the American involvement. And I'd had a bad feeling about it, and I was with Joao again, obviously, and somebody else, and I had a bad feeling. And I said, no, I want to leave. Oh, we'll all leave together. We came together. I could see they really didn't want to leave, and again, I said, okay, fine. And, you know, truthfully, within 2 days, I was wounded again. That's it. War zone's over. And I don't think it's lack of commitment from anyone who decides what they want to do on that. I think it's just to do with what you feel comfortable and compelled to do. And whether you do it for 20 years or for 2 years, that's fine.
We just recently had the sister of a Russian journalist who was assassinated. And the book that has been published is something like, is it worth dying for? Is journalism worth dying for? Anna Politkovskaya, is this worth it? I mean, somebody has to do it. It was her argument. If I don't do it, then what's going to happen to these stories? Was that your feeling as well?
I think it's worth the risk of dying. But if you had to say, you will die now if you do this, everybody would say no. But the chance of dying to do what you believe in or what you think should be highlighted, and it is. I think it's worth it. And I think people take these risks. But as long as they take them knowingly, it's their choice.
So you're still working as a photojournalist?
Photojournalist, writer, filmmaker, but not in war zones.
And Ryan, you also are interested in making films,
yeah,
producing films. Mm-hmm. What's next for you?
I have a series that I sold to Showtime about a town car driver in Manhattan. It's like a dark comedy. So I'm working on that as a producer, and I start shooting a film with Zooey Deschanel in Los Angeles in June. And I'm about to direct my first short film.
Just one more question. Your name is Philippe. Any reasonable person would pronounce it Philippe. How did it become Philippe?
It is a French derived name, and my ancestry is French, and I think it was just Americanized. You took Parisians who moved to Tennessee, and I think somehow it got changed to Philippe.
Thank you both so much for being with us, Ryan Philippi and Greg Marinovich. We've been talking about the Bang Bang Club, which opens tomorrow at the Village East Cinema as part of the Tribeca Film Festival. The book has been reissued in paperback by Basic Books with a new cover featuring the stars of the film, mm-hmm, including you, Ryan.
Yep.
Thank you both so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thank you.